Today, we are excited to be doing True Colors Podcast Episode 9. Y'all, we are already at 9 episodes. Thank you to everybody who has been rocking with us over the last several episodes. It's exciting to have a chance to chat with all the amazing artists that support the work that we've been doing and are bringing you all this great content. Like we've been doing for the last couple of weeks, this will also be a fundraiser for True Colors. We are in the middle of our hashtag WeAreTheMagic campaign. So we thanks everybody. We want to send a special thanks to everybody who's been supporting the work of True Colors. If you go to our website right now, we are doing matching donations with the City of Atlanta during our Power to Give. So thanks for donating here via the Instagram app, but also go to our website so that your donations can be matched thanks to the City of Atlanta's Power to Give. Today, I am so happy to be joined by Tinashe Kajese Bolden. She is a multi-hyphenate. She is doing her thing. She is kicking ass all over the Atlanta and also nationally. So we're really excited to have her here. And we're going to talk a little bit about her. But I also wanted to shout out quickly Men Not Miss, thanks to Eugene Russell, his amazing wife, Naima Russell, and their work that they're doing with Men Not Miss to represent Black fatherhood. So I decided to wear my hoodie today. But now that I've gotten that out the way, y'all, let's get excited. Let's get excited to welcome Miss Tinashe Kajese Bolden in. As she joins, just list off a couple of things that Tinashe has done. You guys have seen her on stage in Proof in Detroit 67. You've seen her directing with Schoolgirls of the African Mean Girls play. She is a bold fellow at the Alliance Theater, one of our friends right up the street here in Atlanta. She has national and worldwide recognition as a Princess Grace awardee. You're going to see her in movies coming up. She's in some scenes with Idris Elba. Guys, like, we only have an hour, so I can't list all of the amazing accomplishments Tinashe has. But one thing I do want to shout out is that she is the amazing mom to some beautiful boys. So since we are representing parents here, I want to make sure that we shout that out. But welcome, Tinashe. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hey, Jamil, how are you?
Good, friend. I'm good. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining me today. Tinashe, man, it is so fun just to get a chance to chat with you. I have so many friends and colleagues who are doing some amazing work, but every time I look up, your name is next to another amazing project. So today I wanted to, I'm tearing up. Your work is so good.
Don't get so emotional just yet. We have plenty of time to cry later.
I'm so sorry, y'all. Every time I try to go without my glasses, my tears start to show up. But I'm a theater thug, so I might have to put these on. Anyway, so Tinashe, let's talk. Let's start at the beginning. When did you know that you wanted to be in this industry?
You know, I think that I didn't even know that there was an industry. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Zimbabwe and in Kenya, and the notion of even being an actor was never, it wasn't that it was quelled, it just, I didn't see it represented around me. And, you know, I grew up post-apartheid in Zimbabwe, and so unfortunately there's a lot of association with theater and those kind of people. You know, there's a very African notion of, well, those are what prostitutes do. So that I would do a couple plays, but I was more into, you know, being in the school band, and I was a painter. I actually got accepted to the London National School of the Arts very young, and I was going to become a fine arts person. But I always dabbled in a little bit of plays whenever there was an opportunity. And then I just had hit a, you know, like most young people, I was done with my parents and I wanted to get out of Africa. And so my parents agreed to let me come to the States to stay with my mom's sister. And my mom's from the States and she lived in Illinois. And I came here about 9 months before I was supposed to start school at Stanford. I got accepted into the program at Stanford and I had 9 months to kill. And I really still didn't know I could do this as a profession, but I was like, this is what I'm gonna do. I know it's gonna make my father really upset and that's fine with me. And while I was in Illinois, my uncle told me, you know, you got to get out of the house after 3 weeks of staying inside. And so I ventured onto the U of I campus and saw a production of, it was Gem of the Ocean. And I had never seen that many Black people on stage telling that were not like my culture, but the invitation inside of it was, this is your story too. And I never experienced that much production level and just the power of it all. Long story short is that I ended up auditioning for their program there and got a full scholarship. And it really changed the trajectory of my life, both personally and professionally, going to the University of Illinois.
So it was the experience with seeing Wilson on stage. It was the opportunity at U of I to work with the drama department. You got both your undergrad and master's degree there, or?
No, I was in the BFA program, but they have a BFA and an MFA program. And the amazing thing about U of I's program is that it is a studio, but in a large university. So I trained in the same way that many of our master students. I had the same, you know, professors. And in my own, you know, ego, I felt like I am full up right now with all the craft that I need right now. And I don't want to go to grad school because I'm doing the same thing these master's degree people are doing, you know? And I just was so hungry to get to New York. I just was like, all roads lead to New York and all roads lead to Broadway. And then I will have arrived. That's what I'm doing. So that's what my goal was.
So let's talk a little bit about some of those, you know, those steps along the journey. Cause you know, it's easy for us to start with all the success that you're having in the moment. But what's been really amazing with this podcast is that we've been talking to people about the journey. We don't have to go step by step, but what are some of those, what's the highlight that lets you know, okay, yes, I'm as fierce as everybody else, but then what are the moments when you had to sit in a room somewhere and you got to ask that question, like, oh, can I do this? Am I tough enough? Do I have the endurance? Maybe share one from each bucket.
I think for me, what was a real, awakening for me going to New York was that I went in like the early 2000s, where if you were a brown and curly haired, you need to be able to sing. And that just was not my thing. Like I'm an actor, right? And so I had a really hard time having to pivot and figure out, well, what is the thing that I'm going to be bringing into the room, even if I'm going into a musical audition? And the skill I brought in was just tenacity. Like, I'm going to act circles around all these singers, so you're going to think I can sing. And that served me well. My first Broadway show was a musical. I had no business in it, but I did it, you know. But then you go from a high of that and you realize, even though I'm on a Broadway show, I can't afford my rent. And you deal with that emotional recalibration of, I'm doing the show at night and I still have to do a day job. And that was really... I was really humbling, and there were many nights where I thought, why am I doing this? There's no other mountain I can climb. Isn't this the mountaintop? And that's when you start thinking, why am I doing this? And and really for me, I started changing. It can't just be about going from show to show to show, but what is the legacy I want to leave? And who are the people I want to reach? And what is the conversation I want to change, not just in my community, but in other communities? And that's when I know the shift happened for me about what is my power in the room? Mm. And once you start losing power as an artist, you start losing purpose. Mm. So I had a long period of years where I struggled between making deposits into my financial account or into my creative account. And I was always torn between the two. I might book something that paid my rent, but I wouldn't want anybody to watch it, you know? Or you do these great projects where you just feel like you're pouring your soul out every night and people are coming up to you afterwards and thinking it, you know, their lives were changed, but I'm now going to a shift of work after this because I can't afford to keep this up. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, like, you know, the things are like I'm excited, and I'm like, because you're just dropping these amazing, like, just gems and these things about, you know, filling up your financial bank, but also filling up your creative bank, and how do you navigate that? And I think that's an amazing thing, and I want to come back to that. But I love what you're talking about, being tenacious, and how tenacity has driven you, and how far it's taken you, but also recognizing your power in the room. All those three things are the ones that popped out to me with what you're saying, and it makes so much sense in watching your the journey that I know of. We've been together, we've known each other for about 3 years now, but I can see those things playing out, and it's such a gift for you to share that with other people. So just thank you for that. Talk a little bit about tenacity, and especially in a body like yours, like a brown woman. Curly hair, sometimes that can be intimidating for some people, right? Or some people want to reduce your power in a room because of the body that you inhabit. Can you speak to a little bit to how your tenacious nature has served you? And then what are some of the roadblocks? How have you had to sidestep people who want to put that and use that as an impediment to giving you everything that you deserve?
You know what really can be a trigger, I think, for a lot of actors, but specifically actresses and more so actresses of color, when you talk about this, you know, the body, your body. And for so long, you know, how we look, you know, our industry is the one industry where you can still discriminate based on somebody's appearance, right? And especially as an actor, it that was one thing that I was like, I can't change this. Right. And to some people, it was, oh, well, of course you're going to get all the work because you're light skinned and curly hair. And then it's like, well, you're never going to be the lead. You're always going to be the best friend. You're not tall enough to be convincing in a Shakespeare. So, of course, you're going to play the squire, you know. And so I was told no or not yet or somebody else a lot of the time. And so what I learned was that don't wait to ask for acceptance. Just go after it before they've even formulated who should be in this role. So the minute I would find out that a show was about to get produced, I would send my headshot and resume out before the casting call because I was like, I don't want you to start forming your opinion of what this role should be. I'm going to tell you what it should be. And I found that that was really born from being at the University of Illinois. And realizing that I had had this advantage of growing up around people that looked like me. And I never felt that the fight was a fight of race, it was a fight of class. And when I went to the U of I for the first time, I was in a predominantly white setting. And I saw how the black students would agitate the creative leaders to say, what you're picking out is not serving us. And it really taught me to challenge what other people's opinion or perception was. But it's scary, right? It's scary to put yourself out there and then not have all the answers and not sure if you're the right person for it. So I think the tenacity served me in that I always wanted my work to speak for me. And I'm still like that. I'm married to someone who his personality gets him into the room. And then people are like, oh, wait a minute, did you come into audition? And for me, I'm like, I don't even want to talk to you until we've done the work. That's my passport. But man, I'm just going on a tangent, Jamil, because I'm like thinking of so many rooms that I've gone into.
About it, like what it is, man. This is just me and you kicking it. We got a couple people watching. Thanks for everybody who's watching. Thank you guys for your continued support of True Colors. It is because of people like Tinashe, the magic that is just like some people don't get this opportunity, Tinashe, right? Like they don't get this chance to just to chat with artists. So like don't stop yourself. Like let's just talk, let's flow, you know. This is
You know
this.
what I, but you know what I also know, Jamil, is that people don't understand the story behind each artist,
Right.
right? And we bring that with us into a room. You bring trauma, you bring joy, you bring victory, you bring all those things into a room. And it's when we're afraid to share that when we're afraid, and it's not that we're going to prostitute our, experiences, just to get a job. But if you don't let those scars and stumbles and victories inform how you add DNA to this character, then it's just not an authentic experience. And I think that's what people relate to.
It's gonna fall flat, and no one is looking for that. No one, that's not why we go. That's not why we go to live theater.
No, and I also think, oh, go ahead.
Also, that's not why we go to performance in general. We don't want to see, we don't want you to leave it at the door. Like, that's not, we can, that shit don't fly.
Yeah, and there was also this thing that's happened to us is that reality TV gave people this false sense of what reality is. And they gave them this appetite for what they think reality is. And they don't want to see these characters, right? People want to know exactly who you are the minute you walk into the door. And so, what I always tell my students or actors in a show, I cast you because of who you are. So now you elevate yourself up to that character, but don't lose who you are on that journey. And I think you look at any of these great character actors, there's always some essence about them that is still there. That's the through line. That's why we trust and will go on that journey to believe that you've become this other person. But it's just not denying your own story.
Yeah, word. So Tinashe, you bring you everywhere you go, and you have found yourself in rooms, and you find yourself wearing different hats, which is one of the things that I admire about you. I used to have a little signature line, and the wearer of many hats, and then I met you, and I was like, I had to delete that. There's somebody who's wearing way more hats than I am. Can you talk about what that navigation is like for you? When I think you spoke a little bit about, recognizing your power in a room and not wanting to have that minimized. But can you just talk about how you have decided how you want to show up in rooms, and when you want to wear a certain hat?
Yeah, it comes from just a total desire of wanting to always be working. And I think it's because I don't come from a family of artists. Like my siblings are doctors. My father was, a huge corporate guy. My mother's a surgical nurse. My parents had, and my family have reliable jobs, right? And so I think, and I've always thought, like, God, why did you make me an artist? Like, I am somebody who needs predictability, and I'm in the most unpredictable career. Tell me, what was your question again?
You're on it. Like, how are you navigating?
Navigating. Right. So, it's yes, it's navigating. It's also just trying to keep as many things going at the same time, but realizing that I need to focus on some things more than others. So there's going to be some stuff that's just going to take preference and be front and center, and having a support that can help me achieve that. And I think that a way that I navigate is by really clearly defining what I can offer to a situation and keeping myself accountable and those people that I engage with saying, hey, this is what I can bring in this amount of time. And not being, I mean, I don't, I'm not always successful at it. I think that's the thing I had to learn is letting go when I feel like I fail, letting go when I feel like I've missed this and that with my kids and feeling really bad about it. And then, or letting go of stuff where if I show up in a production meeting and I'm asked a question and I remember that I did not look at the Dropbox the night before and I have no idea what my lighting designer is talking about. So I think that a way to navigate is by being transparent, by staying in the moment. I'm not really sure what this question's about. Let's move, can you help me understand this better? And not being afraid of that, of not knowing, not being afraid of not having all the answers.
Yeah, I think it freed me up both in my process as a director, and then in the positions of leadership that I've been able to assume, saying I don't know. Right, like it makes you a real person. We talked about not, being flat, not checking yourself at the door. Hey, sometimes I'm gonna walk in a room and I've been doing everything else but doing the thing that I want, that this meeting is about. And I'm gonna be honest with you, like, hey, y'all, like, that's just where I'm at right now. But I'm gonna try to be present in this moment to give what I can.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's a lack of preparedness. And I think that's what I would so stress to other artists, especially Atlantan artists. I am a big proponent of being prepared because then you are less fearful to navigate the unknown. So it's kind of like, we talk about an actor's toolbox, the director, like, how do you front load before you get into a project so that you confidently say, I have researched and read everything I possibly can, but I have no idea where you're supposed to stand in this moment. Let's figure this out together.
Well,
And
and
I think
you talk.
sometimes people I just think sometimes people underestimate the importance of preparation because it will inform you not just about this project, but the one to come and the one that's 10 years from now.
You've been building up an amazing career, not just here in Atlanta, but nationally in all of the different hyphens that you've been able to play. Here's an let's celebrate some of that. Tinashe, talk to us about what did it feel like to win the Princess Grace Award? It's nationally recognized that it has an international following. You're with names like Leslie Odom Jr., who's won it before. What does it mean for you as a testament to that person who was in a Broadway show who couldn't pay her rent? What does it mean for you to be recognized like that in such a capacity?
Just to keep it really surface level, it was so amazing to go back to New York, have a town car pick you up, have a beautiful hotel, have just be treated in a way that was just so celebratory of the grit and just the stuff you've had to go through. It was so like it was just the little things. Like I got the hotel and there was this gift there and I called Keith and I was like, oh my God, like they know my name. Like this is real. And there's like a little Chardonnay and cheese platter. And it was like so silly. And yet you're like, wow, these people know that they're not just celebrating what I did, but they're celebrating this pro the projection that I'm on. And like you said, it's just with these theater greats, and you go into this space of literally royalty. I've never met a royal person in my life, and when I met the Prince of Monaco, because he, comes and greets every single person, and you get a picture with him, and it's a really powerful sense of validation that you are doing the right thing. So I think to share that with other artists and to share that through the eyes of my husband, who has been my partner from the beginning, when we were doing children's theater and driving around our little Pontiac, those are the wins that just tell you to keep on going. And it's not because it's an award. I mean, yeah, but I think that the financial element to it too is super supportive because it also frees you up to say, hey, I now have this foundation to be able to try new opportunities and build new relationships. And that's what this is all about.
Yeah, word. Just wanted to give a quick shout out to Mr. Robert Connor, who is supporting the work of True Colors. Thank you very much, sir. Great Atlanta theater maker, director, Dominion Productions. We are super thankful for that. And thanks for everybody else who's watching in. I love hearing that story about that because it is an opportunity just to pause, right? To pause and reflect and to be thankful. You telling that story of just riding around in a Pontiac doing children's theater and then to get to be recognized in that kind of way. It's amazing. We've been talking a little bit to people about this moment, right? Like we are all watching this because we're all stuck at home, but we're working and we've been trying to build up some stuff. I was speaking to Ken Davenport a couple of days ago when and I talked about the reason why I feel like even on the days when I'm not interested in being focused or the Zoom meetings are getting too plentiful, it's that feeling of being on stage again, giving a curtain speech, being the last thing that separates that audience from getting to see that play, but also feeling the excitement of the actors backstage. I love being in that middle, that intersection between the two. What are the things that you're looking forward to, and what how are you staying busy creatively in this COVID moment? And listen, I know, yeah, go ahead.
So I'm looking forward to so many. The first moment I'm looking forward to is that moment, that first day of rehearsal after we've done the first read through and we hear the play out loud and all the creative team is there and you're right on the precipice of possibility and people are excited about it. They're still grateful for the job and it's like we're about to launch. That moment of us coming together is what is just something I am, it's this magnet I feel like I'm being pulled towards.
Yes.
But similarly, I mean, we're seeing all these people gathering, right? You're seeing all these pictures of people on beaches and graduations. There is such a hunger to be together. There's such a hunger for community. And while I don't agree with it right now, I do think that the power of gathering and sharing experience, there's going to be Zoom fatigue and screen fatigue, right? And it is such an opportunity for us as theater makers to rise up and answer that. And what we got to ask ourselves right now is, what is that answer going to be? Yes, there's space for us to be thinking about what is this moment that's created this moment, but my eyes are on what is the answer that we need down the road? You know, and what stories are we cultivating and taking care of so that we're ready to share them and we can be reminded of our shared humanity? Because don't you remember that moment where it felt like all the world was coming? It was like kumbaya. There was this moment for like a week where we all realized how awful this was and we all needed to take care of each other. And I felt like our borders were so porous, and there was this sense of we have to take care of our neighbors. And you were hearing these great stories, and then that all went away. But that moment can be recaptured. And I think that our global consciousness has been raised, and I want to take advantage of that.
Well, I think too, in that moment, I posit that artists were leading that moment, right? Like artists were, we were the ones who were leading and encouraging that level of connection and community, the ones who were reaching across those borders and those boundaries to say, no, like because of this moment, we too are like the Italians, we too are like those in China, we too are like the Australians, we too are. We too are every community being touched in Africa, in Latin America, right? So I was very appreciative of the way artists were stepping up.
And how did people respond? How did they create community? They banged pots and they made music. They sang, you know, they shared in community workouts. These are all tradition and acts of theater. And that just speaks to the root of what our work can do. It can just, it, I do think that it can close that gap of otherizing other people and other cultures. So now what I hope is that when we start doing plays that are set in Africa, that are set in Bosnia, you know, that we can, it's not their story, but how do we see ourselves in that?
Yeah, we're with True Colors audience members, Atlanta Theater audience members have seen you on stage, behind the scenes, doing a couple of different things at True Colors. And I'm sure one day, if and when you want to, you'll take my job and
Don't leave us. No, you can't leave us, Jamil.
that we need. But talk a little bit about the work that you've been able to do at True Colors. What things stick out? Is it, you know, is it a Detroit 67? Is it a proof? Like, what are those things that stick out from your time in the various capacities you've played at True Colors?
Detroit 67, I mean, it was the first show that I did in Atlanta. So for me, it was like the gift of first, but also the insecurities you got to get over being the new person in town and the whole cast. I mean, that whole cast knew each other, and it was like Atlanta's must know, Tanya Jackson and Eraj and Enoch, you know, and so it's a little intimidating to walk into a room where everybody knows each other, and again, like I just used my own feeling of being an outsider. I just fed that into who Shelby, you know, she felt like she was an outsider in her own family. And so I found a way just to bring those feelings I had and turn them into a creative choice. And I just love working with Camilla Forbes. I mean, there's something about working in a room with a director who her she just creates a safe space, and she was exciting and thrilling. So that was great. But I think for me, one of the roles that just I think about often and it comes back to me often was Proof. And I think it's because there were so many things going on in my life personally that seemed to just intersect with this role of being this older sister. And I was 5 months pregnant when I was doing that play. So that was a real balancing act for me. And it was a test on can I have a family and be an artist and take care of my family and serve this role. So that was a challenging time, but it was fun. Like I just love that role.
Yeah, people will get mad at me if I don't talk about Schoolgirls at some point. But before I get there, I want to sit here because I want to be real about like if we can we just be real about what does it mean to be a parent and a theater maker and someone who is in high demand? Like, I know I've been struggling and at various points during not just this quarantine but just over the last several years of wanting to be present, wanting to own up to my responsibilities as a partner and as a parent, and also recognizing that, like, I've had this dream, I've had this passion, I've been asked to carry a load, I've been asked to work on this art. And because ours is not our jobs, sometimes it can feel like they aren't as essential or what have you, or that we are privileged in the sense, because we live in a, we do a privileged thing, but it's a calling, right? Can you talk about how you've navigated that, wanting to be present, but also knowing that you've been called to do something else?
Yeah, there's a lot of nights where I gotta check my frustration because I feel that like I put my career on hold for many years to carry the child, to take care of my kids, and I always, even though I have a partner who always said, "Hey, go after it, do whatever you want." I oftentimes would say no to work because I did not want to be away from my kids, or I felt like I just did something I shouldn't. This was my first one with my first son, and so I really pulled back on a lot of opportunities because I was afraid. I was just afraid that I wasn't going to be a good mom, and then with my second son. Things had started to really move for me in my career here, and things were just popping off. I mean, I was shooting Henrietta Lacks throughout most of my pregnancy. I then was doing Proof, and then found out that I was going to direct Eclipse 4.5 weeks after he was born. So there was just no time to rest. And I just started working so much, I felt like if I don't take advantage of this time now, I'm gonna lose this. And the good thing is that then it just like work begot work, more work. That was also a problem that I'm still trying to figure out and how to navigate. But it's hard. If nobody tells you I don't want to be the person that's complaining, oh, I can't be there because of my kid. I don't want my kids to be looked as like an excuse. But I also want to go after I'm a woman of a certain age. And there's not a lot of work that's down on the other side that if I don't start creating it and building those relationships and laying that groundwork now, I see it that way. So I'm working hard right now so that I can set up a career for me that I think was just destined to happen and flourish later in my life. I do think that.
Lauren, my wife, she challenged me all the time on, like, what can you do to change the culture so that those things that seem to be impediments don't have to be impediments for anybody else? So, we are trying to find ways to be a little bit more flexible. How can we bring kids into workspaces? How can we make sure, because artists like you, we don't want you to have to create. We don't want you to feel like you got to decide, can I take a show? Can I work on this thing? Or do I be a parent? So we are working on it. So I appreciate the encouragement and people like you and other parents that have worked at True Colors to help us shift our culture so that we don't have to force artists into this false dichotomy, because it's not real. It doesn't have to be real. We can change it. It is our structure. We're able to change it. So here we are. Now let's talk about this hit that was Schoolgirls, or the African Mean Girls play. That was just the last thing that we did at True Colors, right before the world stood still for a little bit. One thing that Jocelyn Beal, the playwright, said during the closing toast was that in her wildest dreams, she didn't imagine seeing the stories that she wrote reflected back in the audience. Speak a little bit about, as you're navigating that, as you're working and you're in the middle of it, and you're in the middle of that 10 out of 12, or you're in the middle of that run through that just doesn't go the way you want to, how do you see like that end result of having sold out audiences and people experiencing the art the way in which you had intended? Can you speak a little bit about like what is that birthing process, and how can you and delivering it to an audience that you know is going to appreciate and receive it the way you intended?
You know, I think so much of that is born and nurtured out of how we make the ensemble. And if we don't find that joy, that love, that fulfillment in the work at the beginning, and really protect that and grow that feeling and that connection, it's not gonna just automatically happen when an audience comes. And so for me, usually within the first week and a half of a show, I get a gauge of how I think an audience is going to feel. And I think a lot about how do I want an audience to leave this experience? I want them to feel like, yes, we've agitated them out of their comfort zone, but we have given them this possibility of a whole new landscape that they may not have thought about. So, what are ways that we can? What's the invitation inside of our experience? But I don't think that can be manifested just by the blueprint of the script. It has to be a genuine thing that happens amongst the actresses. And that's why for me, I think there's something really exciting about bringing together a group of women who might not have been, who are hungry for it, right? Or bringing together a group of artists who might have been overlooked. And I always am really intentional about thinking who is yes creatively ready for this, but their hunger is going to drive them to seek every opportunity of connection. So we had a lot of bumpy roads in that experience, and I think the bumpy roads were necessary because a lot of the women found that yes, this was a play that was inherently a comedy, but its backbone was on so many deeply painful lived experiences that all of these women had. And they were all such a diverse group of women. And so we knew just based on the diversity in this room, that's going to be reflected in our audience. And our audience is going to come and say, oh my God, that is exactly how I feel. And I'm having the same issues with my sister who doesn't understand. So I'm going to bring her so that we can talk about this play. But what we're really talking about is each other.
You're the first director that I've been able to have a chat with on the podcast, so I want to talk a little bit about just directing, since the directing is a lonely profession, right? Like we are often the only ones in the room, and as lead curators, we are the ones who are helping to set the vision. I want to talk a little bit with you about what's your process, from the moment that you get a script, process on communicating the vision that you create in your head to all of the various collaborators that you have to do. Do you have a set one? Does it change based on your play? And go.
You know what I know about myself is that I am just drawn like a moth to the flame of like these small intimate moments of human connection and interaction. And so when I read a play, I just read it and I flag, oh, there's the relationship. Oh, that's when the relationship started to fragment. Oh, there's a relationship again. I've noticed that that's how I process a play, is the relationships that come together, the coming together and the breaking apart. And then I read it again just to see, well, what are the circumstances that caused that? So I start to then pull back, right? And then as I read it more, I start to think about how do I explode this moment in a visual picture that will help support it as well? How would I imagine these bodies moving through space? And what does the light feel like? What does the environment feel like? Am I closed in? Is it open? And that leads me to then start looking at designers' portfolios and what their aesthetic is. And I found that, you know, when I was first directing, and I think with Synchronicity, I was kind of given a lot of my designers. Mm-hmm. You inherit them, right? Because the theater's like, this is who we have and this is who you're going to use. And so you figure it out. But as I started really learning how I wanted to collaborate with people, I realized that you have to have an anchor. Every designer is super important. But for me, the set designer is my anchor, because that's the audience's first experience with a play. So when they walk in the room, what do they see and where have you taken them? So I always begin with that conversation. And then the lighting and costume designers, you know, the costumes are this, how are we telling this language through material, and where is the overlap with other elements on stage? And I've really found that, I mean, it depends on the show, but I don't think of it as a costume, but more as clothes. And so how do we make sure that there's real ownership amongst the actors? And I will say this, Jamil, I know that my experience as an actor has just truly informed the way that I communicate and interact with designers. And also my experience with architecture, because I have a degree in that, in interior architecture. So my comfort about talking about material surfaces and how they make us feel, how a bumpy surface makes an audience feel, you know, all of that just comes into play. So that what my job is, like, how do I unearth the most useful tools to tell a given story and then inspire this team of collaborators that I've put together? And I don't see my job as, like, so once I'm grabbed with my team, then my job becomes a pace setter, right? And so how do I make sure that I am editing things and I'm cheering people on, but I'm also keeping us on pace towards this vision that I ultimately have?
That's beautiful, man. That's really great. Again, I love talking shop to artists. So again, thanks for everybody who's sticking around. It always feels like these are like living room sessions and salon sessions. So I really feel like sometimes I'm taking advantage. So I do want to remind everybody, if you have questions for Tinashe in about the 10 minutes or so that we have left, please go ahead and drop them here in the chat. Thanks to Jeff for your donation. Really means a lot. Appreciate it. Thank you, everyone who's been leaving some really great comments as we talk. Tinashe, you talked a little bit about setting pace. You talk a little bit about bringing your full self and all of the knowledge and intelligences that you have help you communicate as a director, and it makes you a more dynamic director. Can you talk about the ways in which you are? How do you learn? How do you grow? How do you get better? How are you challenging and pushing yourself? Because it seems like it could be real easy to rest on your laurels. You've had an amazing career up until this point. You were receiving the accolades. But what is it outside of your own tenacity, which I think is great, but how else are you pushing yourself forward in learning and growing your craft?
A big part is trying to surround myself with people with more experience. So as I'm able to choose my own designers, just really going after folks that just got far more experience and have worked with huge, wonderful, amazing directors. That's one way. Also, the wonderful thing about my position at the Alliance is that I can go and sit in on rehearsal spaces with visiting directors. And what a gift, because like you said, what we do, it's a very siloed experience of the theater. And so to go in and sit down and hear how other directors are communicating, what is working, how actors are responding, how they how they get over stumbling blocks. That's been really, really encouraging to me. And reading, I mean, I'm reading every book that I can on directing and also just on humanity, you know? And I think that's what I'm doing right now. What I wish I was able to do would be like to go off and take a whole bunch of courses, you know? I am definitely somebody who loves to be in a classroom. And so the only thing I can do right now is try to create a class, be in a classroom of the rehearsal space.
What shout out a book. What's the directing book that you're really enjoying right now?
Yeah, so I've been reading like I mean ignore the falling lights. Like Anne Bogart's An Actor, sorry, Director Prepares is really a great read. And also the open space, oh yeah, the empty space. Peter Brooks, The Empty Space. This is a really good book. Just, you know, thinking outside of how we traditionally stage or imagine a play. And I think that's the next hill that I'm wanting to overcome, is really taking a lift off of what's on the page and thinking in a much more dynamic, you know, what is possible way.
The one that I always return to, and I try to read it, reread it every time I go into a rehearsal hall, and sometimes I'm more successful than others. It's a Notes on Directing. I believe it's written by Frank Hauser and
Yes,
or something like that, right?
I have the Kindle of that. Yes.
I want a lot. And for me, the thing I always have to remember is every scene is a chase scene. That's one of my favorite notes in there, that every scene, actor, someone wants something and they are in pursuit of that. And whether they're being thwarted or not, those are the tactics, those are the objectives, those are the things that can play. That's the action that we want to pursue on stage. So, yeah, I love that. Again, like I said, I love talking craft. Before I let you go, Tinashe, this is the season of the She Griots. We are celebrating Black women storytellers all season long at True Colors, and we are running until this current season runs until July 31st. But we are wanting to just remind people, although we have had to postpone our production of Maria and Rosetta, when we are able and it is safe for people, especially people that look like us, Black people, to come back to the theater, we will bring Maria and Rosetta back. We will close out the She Griot season when that happens. But you gave us in your She Griots challenge. Thank you for doing that. You told us a little bit about what does it mean to be a She Griot. For those who haven't had a chance to check that out, we encourage you to do it. But give us a little taste again. What does it mean for you to be a She Griot? Who are the She Griots in your life that you want to shout out?
Being a she griot is, I think, being present in the moment and collecting stories of the moment wherever you are right now. And I think it's also being a contributor and speaking up and knowing your truth and creating a safe space for other women to tell their stories. For me, I feel like that is what my role is just to keep holding that door open and inviting conversation that reflects the city we're in and also the world that we want to be in. Right now, I tell you, my mom is such an amazing person. She's with us right now, and we are experiencing this time where she's able to share stories in the moment of what I did as a kid, because she's seeing my sons doing it at the same time. And so while it's very humbling, it's just brought a lot of laughter and joy. And I'm really grateful for it, especially when we're ex telling having some really hard, tough conversations. My mom is Caucasian, she's from Kansas, and she's lived in Africa most of her life, but topics of race are they can be hard even within a family. And this time together has challenged our conversations. And I'm grateful that my sons can witness the stories and conversations that we're sharing.
Yeah, man. Well, y'all, thank you very much for listening in. Thank you, Tinashe, for sharing all of the gems that you shared with us for from the beginning of reminding people that there are things that are going to fill up your financial bank, and there's also things that are going to fill up your creative bank and how you navigate that. Reminding us to be tenacious. I think we had a couple of tenacious Tinashes that were here in the chat. Don't be mad at me if that becomes your new nickname. I say it a lot. You were reminding us that, not to let other people see you, your body, to limit you and to be reminded of your power and how you hold power. You talked to us about how you navigate all the different dynamics of, when you choose which project, what type of art do you want to create in that moment, but also how you show up in rooms and you bring your full self. So you just dropped so many gems along the way. I encourage people to that, if you came in at the end of it, please rewind it back. We're about to put this on IGTV, but thank you very, very much, Tinashe, for sharing your time with us. We really, really appreciate you. I know you got a tons of things that you could be doing, but thanks for rocking with us for the last hour or so.
Can I give you a shout out, Jamil? I so appreciate these podcasts. I so appreciate the work that you are doing at True Colors and within our community. And you are just such an inspiration, and I appreciate you. I appreciate you. I love you. And I thank you for all that you're doing.
Thanks, man. Thanks. Yeah, thank you. I love you too, Tinashe. Thank you so much. All right, y'all, come check us out next week. We will be back with the True Colors Podcast, episode 10. This is our final single-digit show. We were happy to have Tinashe on there, but we'll be back next week, Thursday, 1 o'clock p.m. You know where to check us out. Until then, y'all, be safe. Stay your ass at home if you don't have to go out. Stay your ass at home. Be safe so we can gather together again. Bye, y'all.
Bye.